Very good. This is the last morning of the retreat. This afternoon, the retreat ends. Although all these things are always uncertain, the future. You never know what happens in the future. I was joking with someone the other day that maybe I should arrange for a bus this afternoon about 3 o'clock so we can take everyone down to the monastery and ordain the lot of you. I was only joking though. No, it doesn't come out of that one because the radio phone, radio microphone would also come out in their church next door where they're holding their religious devotions. So the talk I want to do this morning is just actually to more like a summing up talk and bringing things together on what we've been doing this last 9 days. And especially just to encourage the further practice of meditation. I did make a point, as I do with the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, when teaching meditation, to teach it methodically so that the meditator can get a very clear picture of the stages and the steps into deep meditation. And if one knows those steps and knows those stages, then you'll find that the journey into these deep and profound states of meditation will be much quicker and less troublesome. At least one knows the way, and the signs on the way are very easy to pick out so you don't get lost. And in meditation, one can lose a lot of time just thinking one is peaceful, thinking one is doing the right thing, but then again, not really doing it properly. And also, some of the techniques which I've talked about in order to attain those stages are very powerful techniques. And I bring to your mind the technique of recognizing any obstacle to peaceful meditation as a hindrance, using your knowledge of the five hindrances to know which particular hindrance is the obstacle. And then knowing which particular hindrance is the obstacle, then using the appropriate method to overcome that hindrance. So it is using a lot of your wisdom, a lot of the discriminative faculty of the mind to be able to know what to do at every particular turn in the road towards these peaceful states of mind. And in particular, that if there's an obstacle to your meditation which continually stands in your way, whether that's restlessness, whether that's thought and torpor, whether that's the thinking, whether that's the tendency always to control, to recognize that that's one of your big hindrances and to set yourself up at the beginning of the meditation with a resolution to be very careful during that time of that one particular hindrance above all others. Because when you make that resolution, you'll find that you're establishing this thing which we call mindfulness very strongly inside of you. And hopefully that you will also appreciate that the factor of mindfulness does have two aspects to it. In the original word sati was used by the Buddha to mean not just the knowledge of what there is in the mind, but also the memory, the knowledge of what you should be doing, the knowledge of the Dhamma, the knowledge of the instructions. That's also included in this word sati, which has been translated as mindfulness, but that mindfulness does not convey the full meaning of that word. For example, there's one very meaningful story in the suttas, and I think you might find it amusing. Also, because it shows that even though that monks may be practicing in a monastery, sometimes a diligent lay meditator can outstrip the monks. There was this one story of these two monks who were, three monks I think it was, who were meditating in a forest for the rains retreat. And it was a very remote place, and the only real supporter, the one who really looked after them, was a village woman who would put food in their bowls every day and would go to the monastery in the evening to make sure that the monks had everything they need, and really protected those monks so they could do a lot of meditation. And she looked after them with so much diligence that in her spare time, what little spare time she had, she practiced meditation. She listened to their sermons. And she was quite proud of her monks. And it came to the time when the monks died, and then she died. And then they found that the monks had only been reborn in the Tower Tings of Heaven. So it was two monks, not three. The two monks had been born in the Tower Tings of Heaven, which she was reborn two rungs above in the Tusita Heaven. And when she found out about this, that she'd been reborn in a higher realm than they had, I think she was, say, she'd gained the fruit of once returner. And when she found out that these monks had been reborn in, you know, what was actually quite a low heavenly realm, and she'd been reborn in a higher realm, that she went down to that realm and she really berated them, saying, "You stupid monks, I've been feeding you all these years, looking after you, and this is all you can do. Even myself, I didn't have much time to meditate, and I just had to squeeze it in here and there. And you two over here, you've had all that time, I've been looking after you, protecting you, sacrificing for you, and this is the best you can do, just getting into this heavenly realm." And they say that one of the monks just ignored her and just carried on indulging in the pleasures of that realm. But the other monk, because of her admonition, they say that he roused mindfulness, sati. And as soon as sati appeared in him, then he immediately got the fruits of the non-returner and immediately disappeared from that realm and even leapfrogged that woman and went into the pure abodes as a non-returner. And the meaning, the explanation of that is not that he got what we usually call in our Western world mindfulness. He just observed what he was doing. But what had happened was that when he'd been reborn in that realm, that the memory of all of the teachings which he'd heard from the Buddha's mouth himself, the knowledge of all those teachings, they just lost, he'd lost them as he was indulging in the pleasures of this realm. And he just needed that woman to sort of nudge his memory. And he recalled the teachings, he recalled the Buddha's explanation of anicca, dukkha, anatta, the Four Noble Truths. That even the pleasures of the heavenly realms are suffering, are insubstantial, are nothing to do with him. And that's what he recalled, just those teachings which he'd heard many, many times. And in that particular state, a very refined state, and in that situation of being ashamed because of the remonstration from a lay woman who had supported him and giving him all the opportunity and sacrificed her own, in that sort of state, that those teachings which he recalled went straight to his heart, and he abandoned defilements in that moment and immediately got reborn, died from that realm, got reborn in the realm of the anagamis and non-returners. It was a case where the mindfulness was just remembering the teachings, remembering anicca, dukkha, anatta, remembering the Four Noble Truths, remembering letting go, and remembering this not controlling, remembering to not pay any worth to thinking, remembering to doubt perceptions. It was that memory aspect of sati which was a powerful trigger to send that monk off to a much more sublime realm and to cut off the defilements which bound him to the lower realms once and for all. This is one of the important meanings of sati, of mindfulness. And you should know that during your meditation, a lot of time is wasted because the mindfulness, which knows what it should be doing, is not present. The mindfulness which remembers the Buddha's teachings, the instructions about mindfulness, about meditation, has been forgotten. And you know for your own practice that we can spend many meditations just wandering around, and afterwards we know, oh, that's what I should have been doing, but we weren't. It's because of this memory of the instructions hasn't been fully established within us. This is why the Buddha gave the simile of a gatekeeper for this term we call sati. And when he said there's a gatekeeper, it's like a gatekeeper of one of these walled towns. As in medieval Europe, so in India in the time of the Buddha, for safety reasons, the main towns would be encircled by a great wall, and there would be doors or gateways into that walled city or walled town at various points on its circumference. And the, the gates would be locked at night, opened in the early morning. And by each gate would be a gatekeeper, like a soldier, whose task was to make sure that only those who should be, who should enter the city, come in, and those who were a danger or a menace to the city were kept out. And they say the gatekeeper to a city has to be mindful, and explain that mindfulness in two parts. First, he has to be attentive to who's coming in and who's going out. So attentive that it doesn't miss anyone, as it were, slipping in quickly or slipping out unseen. This is that aspect of mindfulness which most of us are familiar with. The mindfulness which clearly knows what's slipping into the mind and what's leaving the mind, and doesn't allow anything to go by unseen. That's the clear mindfulness of attention. However, the other aspect of mindfulness, which is obviously needed by the gatekeeper, is that aspect of mindfulness to know who the villains are, who the robbers, the criminals, the riffraff he wants to keep out of town. He knows those. And he also knows those who are belong to the town, who have their residences there, or who have legitimate business there. The gatekeeper knows, as it were, the instructions, knows who should legitimately enter, and knows who should be barred or kept out from the city. And this is the other function of mindfulness, which remembers what he's been instructed, remembers the wisdom of the gatekeeper. And this is the other aspect of mindfulness which we should also always try and maintain when we're meditating, that wisdom of the gatekeeper to the mind, to know those things which are a danger to you, which once you let them in the mind unseen can actually take over the mind. And of course one of those things which you should know is what we call thinking. Because once thinking gets its foot in the door, then it takes off, and you can spend a whole hour's meditation sort of thinking all sorts of thoughts and not being able to stop that thinking mind. And what's actually happened there, that the mindfulness, you may have known exactly what was going on, but you fail to see this as dangerous, fail to take precautions, one has let it in to the city. The gatekeeper, if it sees something like thinking coming into the mind, if it sees this as an obstacle, as a potential danger right from the very beginning, thinking is so easy to stop. I've given a simile before, I think I gave it to one meditator in the interview room, that thinking is like a locomotive train which is leaving the platform. If there's some problem with the train or with the journey, and the driver finds out about it just pretty quickly after leaving the platform, after it starts, he can slam the brakes off and he can stop very quickly, because the train is not travelling very fast yet. It's only getting going. In the same way with thinking, if the thinking is noticed and recognised as an enemy, that there's something wrong, that the mindfulness remembers this is going to be an obstacle to the meditation. If you can catch it that quickly, it's very easy to say no to it, to stop it. And the thinking stops straight away. You can go straight on back to the breath or whatever other meditation object you're following. However, if the driver doesn't remember the danger and is trundling along the tracks at 100 kilometers an hour, 150 kilometers an hour, with all that weight, with all that momentum, if he puts the brakes on, you can't stop. At least you can't stop very quickly. It takes you a long, 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 long time of applying very strong brakes to get that train to stop. And that's exactly what it's like with the thinking mind. If you allow the thinking mind to sort of pick up steam, to start going fast along the tracks of your mind, and you want to stop it at that point, it's almost impossible to do. You find that it's going too fast and too strong. The point was, your mindfulness forgot that this was an enemy, this was a difficulty. So this is why that the mindfulness of emphasizing or remembering sort of your difficulties in meditation at the very beginning of your meditation, making that resolution, psyching yourself up, saying, I'm going to be aware of this thing because this thing has ruined so many meditations so often, that you find that that is a way of instructing your gatekeeper. And the gatekeepers on our mind, they need to be instructed every morning, every meditation, because they can forget. If that's your obstacle, then look at it as an obstacle. At the beginning of your meditation, make that resolution. My main obstacle is thinking. Or my main obstacle is sloth and torpor. Even with sloth and torpor, as one meditator once told me, it was the best description I've heard. But if you are wary of sloth and torpor, if you tell your gatekeeper that this is my major problem and I'm going to be on the lookout for it, you'll find, as it were, that in your meditation you come to a fork in the road. It's just a metaphor. If you go on the left fork, you get into sloth and torpor. If you go on the right fork, you get into very peaceful but bright, aware states. The mind is becoming peaceful. But you're taking, as it were, the easy turn in the road, giving up the effort, giving up the energy, giving up the clarity. The mind is just getting slack. But there is that point there where the mind just starts to get slack. It starts to turn on that fork. If you can notice that point where the mind turns into the path of sloth and torpor, then you can stop yourself and go the other way. Once you know that point in the road, then very easy to avoid sloth and torpor in the future. However, once you go a few feet down that road, it certainly is like a one-way street. Once you get into sloth and torpor, it's very difficult to get out again. Once you really are feeling sleepy, then you might think, I'm going to try not to be sleepy. And it's very difficult, because when you are sleepy, you can't see what to do to stop you being sleepy. It's like being lost in the mist. You can't find your way out. However, if you can catch yourself just at that fork in the road, you know, this is sloth and torpor, just over there. Stop and take the other direction. Then you can avoid it. And this is what mindfulness is all about. Seeing where you are and knowing your dangers. So you can do that at the beginning of meditation. Is to set yourself up, psych yourself up. This is my danger. This is what I'm going to really be careful of during this meditation. And then, because you say that to yourself at the beginning, you find that you are aware, you are careful. This is how you can establish this type of mindfulness in you. And you can do this with any of the difficulties which you face in meditation. And so that's one of the reasons I emphasize this during this meditation retreat. To know your obstacles, and know the way to overcome them. And this is by far the most important of the ways to overcome them. Recognize them and be wary of them. And then eventually you'll be able to sidestep them again and again and again. And then the other more refined obstacles come up. Do the same technique. When you recognize these as obstacles, then at the beginning of the meditation, that's what you should look out for. Set yourself up, give yourself the warning signs. This meditation, I've got to be wary of excess control, always controlling these things. And then you find when it's the time to let go of control, you can. because you've instructed yourself. You've instructed the gatekeeper. You set up mindfulness. So this is like instructing on like the path on how to train the mind. And again, training the mind like training any other animal. And I just refer again to the simile of the little novice who saw someone training an elephant and said, well, if this small human being can train this big elephant, then surely me, this little novice, can train this little mind. They just gave him the faith to be able to do this. But he didn't say in the story, but I would imagine that the little novice also watched how an elephant is trained, realizing it's not just through brute force, but it's also through wisdom, through their skillful methods of training elephants. The elephant law, the techniques which is handed down from the elephant trainers to their apprentices over the generations. And this is like the meditation law, which I'm passing on. How to train your mind, not just through willpower, but also through these wise, effective methods. And then you find the mind can be trained. And this is the teaching, the main teaching, which I hope I handed over during this meditation retreat. Sometimes that there's always a danger, and I recognize this, when you talk about something like jhanas, these very blissful high states, because you are generating aspiration, you are generating desire, and you're also generating expectation. There is a lot of dangers in that sort of in this sort of teaching. However, there is also a great many advantages as well. And the dangers are those things which I should be able to teach to overcome, whereas the advantages are huge. First of all, if one doesn't even talk about like a word like jhana, the people just don't even get interested. When I was like a young monk, very often that word wouldn't even be talked about. And later on, when it was talked about, you find out that monks were doing these things, were practicing jhanas, just as it was said in the suttas. Then the last thing that the monks would say was that you can teach these to lay people. They said, well, it's okay teaching jhanas to monks, because, you know, monks have got all the right conditions, but it's a waste of time teaching it to lay people. What you should teach lay people is just to feed the monks. and maybe to keep precepts. And that's their main job and main purpose in life, just to feed the monks and to build monasteries. However, that afterwards you started to question this, that, oh no, if I'm giving a talk or teaching a retreat, but isn't this short-selling the lay people? Because when you read in the Buddha's teachings, in the time of the Buddha, there were hundreds of lay people who practiced jhanas. There was, I think it was one sutta, when they were saying, someone was asking, are there arahat monks? They said, yeah, there's hundreds of arahat monks. Are there anagami monks? Yeah, there's hundreds of monks, more than 500, I think they said, which was like a word for a big number. Heaps of anagamis, heaps of non-returners, heaps of stream enterers. What about the bhikkhunis? Oh, there's heaps of arahats, heaps of non-returners, heaps of stream enterers. What about the lay men disciples? Oh, there's heaps of anagamis, heaps of non-returners, heaps of once-returners, heaps of stream enterers. The lay women disciples? Yeah, heaps of non-returners, heaps of once-returners, heaps of stream enterers. And this is the Buddha replying to this person's question. And the person who was asking was one of these wandering ascetics. And he said, well, obviously that your discipline is actually, your teaching is bearing results. But what struck me when I read that was it's not just bearing results for monks and nuns, but also for lay people as well, for the lay supporters. And they weren't short-selling the lay community. And so that's why I say, well, if it could be done in the time of the Buddha, it can be done now. That's why I teach jhanas, to the lay people. And some people can achieve those states. Some people get there. The point is, as soon as I say that, people look around and say, who is it? Who's got jhanas this retreat and who hasn't? And if it's not you, you feel a bit sort of miserable. Why do they get it and I can't? I've been just meditating as hard as they are. And sometimes you find the person who's got the jhanas is the one who hasn't been sitting half as long as you have. They don't come up at sort of 4 o'clock or 4:30. They're always going back to their room early at 9 o'clock. And you can see how much they eat at lunchtime. You see, the trouble is, if you start talking like this, again, you get this aspiration leads to competition. Instead of looking at your own practice, you tend to go look at other people and see how they're doing. You get to this one couple told me, says, I can't let her get enlightened before me. That'd be just too embarrassing. So you see that sometimes when we have aspirations, sometimes we get into competition. And so one of the first dangers of an aspiration to attain something like jhanas is you can't compare yourself with anyone else. These paths which you tread in the world of the mind are very lonely paths. They're just for you. Only you truly know where you've got. And you can bend perception and deceive the teacher, as I told you in that story with Ramunyana Ram and those two temple boys the other day. But obviously that's just a waste of time. If you ever come to the teacher, any good friend, always be very honest about your, and very open about your meditation experiences, because the teacher can help that way. And it doesn't really matter whether you've got there or you haven't got there. What really matters is that you're progressing, you're developing. So first of all, that you look upon these aspirations not as a way of comparing yourself with someone else, but as a way of testing yourself out, to knowing where you are in this path of meditation, so in knowing what the next step is, so you can make progress on this path. And it doesn't matter who gains the highest jhana. What inspires me is like who gains the most progress, who does the most work. Some people may already be starting off with a very good mind, a very beautiful mind, trained in previous lifetimes. Others are just working with a very coarse mind. And it doesn't really matter where one is at, as long as one is making forward progress. And this is another reason why I find it very effective to teach like a goal, like a jhana, because even if you don't achieve such a state in this retreat, the aspiration, the struggle as it were, to actually to move towards that, teaches you so much about your mind and the ways of the mind. If you didn't give yourself such a high goal, you wouldn't strive anywhere near so hard. You wouldn't strive with such subtlety if you didn't have this carrot in front of you, pulling you on with greater incentive. Human beings, no matter whether they're men, women, old or young, from whatever nation, are generally lazy. They'll take the easy way out, unless they're given some incentive. And deliberately, on a meditation retreat, I hold up the beautiful incentive of jhanas. The greatest bliss you'd have ever experienced in your life, greater than sexual orgasm, greater than sort of any drugs, the most blissful, delicious. As soon as I say that, people say, give me, give me, give me. I'll take that. And of course you do that on purpose, because as soon as you start to describe these, and now you all know me for a long time of being an honest monk, I'm not sort of exaggerating or misrepresenting the truth of these states, but what it's doing is like inspiring, encouraging, sort of pulling you further and deeper into meditation. If I didn't mention those states, you'd never aspire for them. And because you aspire for them, you may not reach that high you can actually grab them, but at least you're reaching higher than you would otherwise. You're moving closer. Many people before them, they've only just got to like a samadhi nimitta, only got to the second stage of the meditation. But unless I taught that the jhanas are reached by going through this first stage, then the second stage, and then the third stage of calming down the breath, of rousing the samadhi nimitta, this is the steps into these states. If I didn't teach that, you would not aspire to that stage which is just a little bit beyond you. And every now and again, as you aspire to that stage a little bit beyond you, now and again you can just touch it, even if it's only for a second, because that you reach almost beyond your abilities. You reach and sometimes you can just touch, and it shows you it's possible. Next time you jump, you can reach that little bit higher. Next time you jump, you can actually grab onto it. Next time you jump, you can grab on and hold onto it. You've gained these states. This is just basic psychology of the mind. To be able to incite and urge people to go deeper, make more progress in their meditation. So that's one of the reasons why I've taught in this way. And even if one has not gained any of these deep states, just by talking about this, encouraging it, I think many of you would have found your meditation has been deeper, has gone to areas where you haven't reached before, simply because of that attraction, that drag, that pull towards these profound states. And, as I was saying earlier, in the time of the Buddha, many lay people achieved these states. And in there's no reason why people don't achieve these states these days, and people do achieve these states, ordinary meditators like you and the person sitting next to you. And so it is marvelous that this actually can be done. When you achieve something like a jhana, that you know very clearly this is an amazing state, this is a wonderful state, and you just need a decent teacher to be able to advise you on what this is. And then it gives incredible inspiration. Incredible inspiration on the Buddhist Dhamma. You are standing in the footsteps of the Buddha. The Buddha achieved those states. The Arahats achieved those states. Monks and nuns throughout the centuries have achieved those states. Lay people throughout the centuries have achieved those states. Now you're standing in one of those footsteps, like a jhana. The Buddha called these things Uttari Manusa Dhamma. Uttari means higher, above. And Manusa Dhamma is above the ordinary, worldly, human things. It's like a refined, marvelous, wonderful state. And always will be praiseworthy. Showing that a mind has, even though only temporarily, transcended the material world, gone to a place where they say where Mara is blindfolded, where the hindrances have temporarily been suppressed. Even though it's only a temporary release, it's still a release. You're gaining an experience of what it's like to be released. And so, the experience of any of these states is not just an inspiration because you know that this is where the Buddha stood. That's why I call it a footprint of the Buddha. But also that this is one of the Dhammas which he taught. And you experience it, you can get a feel for it. It actually brings the teachings alive. Before, like teachings, the Dhamma you hear or the Dhamma you read can sound good, it can be inspiring. You may even think you understand it. But you find the understanding is only a superficial level. It's the difference between studying every travel book there is on Paris. You may know a lot about Paris, but it's very different than actually taking an aeroplane and getting out at the airport and actually being in Paris. When you're actually in Paris, it brings the guidebooks alive. And when you actually get to any stage which the Buddha got to, it brings the Dhamma, it brings Buddhism completely alive for you. And that's when you really get inspired by these teachings. Okay, it's only one of the first footprints of the Buddha. Once you get to one footprint and realize its profundity and bliss, then you get some inspiration, some powerful inspiration, to go on to the further footprints. One, because you know you can do it, you get confidence in yourself, and two, because you see, well, this experience is put down in the suttas and it's explained by the monks and the nuns, and here it is. It is actually true. It's an experience. And it gives you faith in the Buddha's teachings. Much greater faith, because you've tested it out. That's why the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha called them, when we call it Suvakkhata, he also said Ehi Passika. He invite you to come and see. Not just to come and see from a distance, but come and like stand in the very footprints where I was. Come and experience these states. Come and experience these teachings. That's one of the epithets which we ascribe to this thing we call the Dhamma. Come and experience these things. To see if they are worthwhile, see if they are true. If one does ever attain one of these jhanas, you'll find the next stage in one's practice is quite frustrating. The next stage in one's practice is trying to get back to those same beautiful state one was before. And this becomes very frustrating in the life of a meditator, because you find it's just so difficult to get back there. And this becomes a struggle which one cannot give up, because once having tasted something like that, one will always have to keep aspiring to return there. And what happens next is, because of that aspiration to return to those beautiful stages, that you get very, very wise on the obstacles again which stop you getting to those stages. You become very clear in your understanding of the right time and place for desire in meditation. You may read somewhere, some places, that some meditators, even someone pointed this out some time ago, that Ajahn Chah says you shouldn't desire in meditation. Other teachers say you should desire in meditation. What does it mean? Are these contradicting one another? And the point is that there is a time for desire in meditation, and there is a time when you have to give up desire in meditation. And the point is that sati, mindfulness and wisdom, should know the right time to apply desire, and the right time just to stand back and let nature take its course. This is the skill in meditation. If anyone has attained one of these deep jhana states, you'll know that the desire to return there to those states, the natural result of the achievement, can sometimes become so coarse and can be applied without any wisdom throughout the meditation, to the point where it does become that which blocks. As I hope I made clear here, the purpose and the way that desire or aspiration should be applied in meditation is specifically at the very beginning of your meditation sit. When you sit down, you get your body comfortable, you may make that resolution about the hindrance, obstacle you want to avoid, your major obstacle, so you instruct mindfulness in that way. Also, make your goal at that point, what you want to achieve in this meditation, for the next half an hour or the next hour, where do I want to get? Wisdom will make sure that that resolution is a reasonable one. I think many of you may have read an article I wrote many years ago in Seeing the Way about the time when I went to a WAYSAC celebration when I was still a student. And I heard, because it was WAYSAC, the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, that the monks read out the story of the Buddha's enlightenment and how he sort of sat under a Bodhi tree and did the jhanas and did all this and did all that. And part of the story was at the beginning of the Buddha's meditation, he made a resolution. He made a goal for himself. What he said was that even though that my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, that I'm not going to move from this seat until I've got supreme enlightenment. He was like, that was his goal there, supreme enlightenment. He set that goal, first of all. And for those of you who read that book know what happened to me, that I thought, well, you know, there's no difference between the Buddha and me, really. You know, I'm a wise student. You know, I know more than the Buddha did about all these things like maths and physics and stuff like that. So I went back to my room. I actually literally did this. I was so inspired, I went back to my room and I said, this is it. Okay, it's, you know, I've got many other things to do in my life. Let's get enlightenment over today, then I can do all the other things later on. So I sat down in my room and with all of the, no, serious. I think I was only 18. With all of the sincerity I could muster, I said to myself as I crossed my legs and say, I'm going to sit here, even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, even though I die, I'm not going to move from here until I become fully enlightened, just like the Buddha. This is WAYSAC Day. In those days, I was pushing myself if I could meditate for half an hour. That's only once a day. When it got to about 45 minutes, I was in very great agony. You know what it's like when you start meditating and you cross the leg and you're in such great pain. But I pushed on. I pushed on and pushed on and pushed on, and it was only 50 minutes. And about, after 55 minutes, I forget exactly how long, about 55 minutes, I couldn't stand the pain any longer. I'd endured as much as I could. And so I got up from my seat. And it was very depressing to see my blood hadn't dried up. My bones hadn't turned to dust. And worst of all, that I was still as stupid as I was before. And that was like the stupidity of making a resolution or a goal which is just way beyond you, just out of pride. But as a meditator, you've had enough experience of meditation now, you should know where you're at, what you can do, and make a goal which just stretches you just that little bit more. You can increase the goal next time. That increase the goal next time as you achieve these stages one by one. So the desire is there at the beginning of your meditation, setting yourself a goal, because that you will find will actually incite you to try that bit harder and to go deeper in your meditation. Once you set that goal up, don't keep messing around with it. Don't keep saying, when is the goal going to be reached? When is the goal going to be reached? When am I going to get into this stage? I haven't got into this stage yet. Shut up with that sort of thought. Once you've set the goal, then the mind should then say, well, what brings this goal about? What are its causes? If I'm going to get to stage two, what do I have to do to bring this stage about? That's how wise desire is applied. Having made the goal, you set about bringing about the causes to achieve that goal. It's like wanting the dishes washed. When are the dishes going to be washed? They're not washed yet. Why aren't the dishes washed? Oh, I hope the dishes are washed soon. That's not the way to wash the dishes. The way to get the dishes washed is to think, now what causes the dishes to be washed? The water and soap and you. Those are the causes. So you get those things organized. And then you look at the causes and put all your energy on the causes. And then after a while you find, yeah, the dishes are washed. Because you haven't wasted your time thinking, when are the dishes going to be washed? I hope the dishes are going to be washed. You've got the causes. And you've worked on the causes. Like a person wishing, when am I going to get to jhana? Oh, I've been meditating so long. When is jhana going to happen? Come on, jhana. Come on, dishes get washed. dishes don't wash themselves. Jhanas, any other stage in meditation, arises because of causes. So having set the desire up, this is what I want to achieve. This is my goal. Look at the causes. If you're going to get to stage one of your meditation, just continuous awareness of the breath, mindfulness, applying yourself, setting up the gatekeeper, looking at the obstacles beforehand and making sure if it's thought or anything else that that's the main obstacle, be wary of it so it doesn't take hold of the mind. When you get to stage one, you've got the causes right and the stage happens. Stage two, full awareness of the breath. I've got to be even more attentive and I've got to be less attentive to all these other obstacles, whether it's sounds, whether it's pain in the body, thoughts. I have to let all of these go. Use that desire to hold on to the breath and that letting go of everything else. You've got the skillful means of maybe looking at the breath in the center of your screen and allowing all these other things to fall off. The skillful means of looking at the breath as a beautiful breath, as a delicious breath, so it actually attracts the mind onto it. And if you do all of those causes, then the result happens. You've got the second stage. If it's the third stage of calming down the breath, calming down the breath, that's a very subtle stage, and this is a place where Ajahn Sraa, Chah, and other great meditators said, watch out for desire here. That's going to be one of the main obstacles at that stage. Because that's the desire which keeps on sort of interfering. You set it, the program of your mind, calm it down, just calm it down. And the mind always interferes. Calm down. Come on, calm down. As you grab hold of the mind and suppress it and push it down. And of course, that's not the way to calm a mind. That just makes it more more activated. This is a time when you have to really start letting go, as I mentioned before, of the controller. That which inside of you is that which does. That's what you've got to calm down. Sometimes people say, and I mentioned this during the interviews with a lot of people, sometimes they say, this means like letting go. So let go. Come on, let go. Let go. And let go. That's not letting go, that's forcing yourself to let go, which is the opposite of letting go, which is why it doesn't work. When you let go, you give yourself that instruction, let go. And then you just wait for that instruction to filter through. Just like a person who is the foreman of a building site or the manager of a company or even the abbot of a monastery. If you give someone an instruction, this is what you should do. You leave them alone to do it. You don't go on at them every second. Lay that brick. Lay that brick. Lay that brick. Lay that brick. You'll have to get a trowel in your back. You just got to give the instruction and then shut up. And that's what you do with the mind at these sorts of stages. Give it the instructions, let go. And let the mind do the work rather than you always being on the mind's back giving instructions. You can understand that's the opposite of letting go. So this is why that desire to let go is very different than letting go. The instructions, let go, let go, let go, is very different than the actual activity of letting go. But this is the time where desire has to be overcome, let go of. Abandoned. And it's once you have your meditation object fully in your mind, you have the full continuous awareness of the breath, that's where desire is let go of. So that's with the problem or the question of should you have desire in meditation or not. There is a time when you have, there's a time when you should let it go. And this is how it works. And that way you find that this is the path which actually leads to success in meditation. Frustration has no place in meditation. This is an obstacle. Frustration is born of impatience, born of a sense of self, thinking that, why can't I do this? I've been meditating all this time, why can't I achieve these states? As long as you think that way, then that is one of the major reasons why you don't achieve those states. When frustration comes up, it comes up from the sense that you are in control, that illusion, and you haven't been able to achieve these states. And that issues forth in statements such as, well, these states aren't really necessary anyway, or maybe there's another easy way to do it. But the point is that it's just coming from a sense of frustration. And frustration is just a lack of patience. The wise person, when they set out on any goal, she will just sustain their attention on that goal, sustain their effort, sustain their aspiration. It doesn't matter what obstacle comes in their way, they will gently, persistently find a way through that obstacle. Gently, persistently, they'll give themselves as much time as is needed. Frustration never arises in their mind. Never do they think, I can't do this. They only think, I haven't done it yet. There's still more work to be done. Those people who are the achievers in this world, or achievers in other worlds, have that degree of patience. It would never give rise to frustration, this idea of inner ill will, inner anger at oneself, or the method, or the teacher, or whatever. It's just a matter of being more patient. Because this is a natural course. Many of you will know the story I tell about impatience, which came from my first meditation teacher. I told one or two people in the interview room. The first meditation teacher I had was he was a lay person, but he was a very good meditation teacher. Very wise. He taught jhanas, and he taught in a very beautiful way. And one of the teachings which he gave, which I always remember, was he was a Thai man. He'd been a monk, but he disrobed and was working in the Thai embassy in London, and teaching meditation just in his days off. And he told this story that when he was very young, maybe 5 years of age, his father or his mother gave him some seeds, some flower seeds to plant in the garden. And he went, it was the first time he'd ever planted anything, and he planted these seeds in his garden. And he would water them every morning. But because the seeds were way under the earth, after 2 or 3 days he started getting frustrated. Been walking these for 2 days and I can't see anything happening at all. His mother had to encourage him, just be patient. And sure enough, after another 3 days, after about 5 days, the seeds had put forth their shoots, and the green shoots were just breaking the surface of the earth. He'd seen there were some results coming. So he lost his frustration temporarily, and he got excited. He watered those flowers, not just in the morning, but the afternoon, the evening as well, twice a day. He watered them and watered them, and after another 3 or 4 days, when they're about 2 inches high, that's when he got frustrated a second time, where he lost his patience. They were growing too slow for him, so he decided to stretch them to make them grow faster. And this little 5-year-old child stretched all of the shoots and killed each one of them. And he said he lost his flowers. But he learned a lot about patience and about frustration, even as a 5-year-old. He said, like, flowers have to be nurtured. They take their own time to grow. And your job is just to nurture the plant, to water it, to fertilize it when it needs fertilizing, to protect it from 5-year-old children stretching them. That's your job. And the plants will grow by themselves. Your job is just to make sure the causes are there. And nature will do the rest. And so it's a beautiful simile for meditation, or for anything which you aspire for in life. Know the causes, how to nurture and protect. And then give the flower as much time as it needs. Willing to be that patient that you can spend your whole life just nurturing just one flower if it's a beautiful and worthwhile flower. These are the causes for the meditation. This is the cause to become enlightened. Nurture those causes. And don't become impatient. Impatience is the slowest way, because it impedes the growth of that flower. Patience is the fastest way, because the flower grows at its maximum rate, which is its natural rate. So remember that simile in your meditation. Don't go around stretching your meditation. Your job is to look for the causes and to cultivate those causes. And beware of frustration. It's just not yet. It hasn't happened yet. Just keep on going. Keep on one more step. One more step. One more step. You can always make one more step. And then those who walk that path with that degree of confidence that it can be done, and are patient enough, will actually see it being done. And that's when it gives one the inspiration. One is just gaining not just a superficial understanding of these Buddha's teachings and of the mind and of meditation. One is going to its very depths, going for broke. That's what I've taught in this meditation retreat. And again, on the way, you've learned many other aspects of your mind. Insight arises on the way. As a natural course, you can't miss it. The techniques which you find actually work to make the mind peaceful, to take it to that just deeper stage, are very profound in their implications. The fact that by letting go you gain so much is like a Zen koan. It doesn't make sense on the surface that you give up and then you become rich. The Buddha always said that. The path to becoming rich is by letting go. But when you meditate and you do let go, you understand the meaning of those teachings. The more you let go, the richer you become. Sometimes the people think, and it's an obvious truth, that's why it's wrong, the obvious truth that the more you control, the more freedom you gain. But you find that the less you control, the more you give up, the more freedom you actually feel. That's why people in our Western world, even though we have all our rights and freedoms, seem so imprisoned, seem so stressed, seems so like they're in bondage to something. Whereas those people who, for example, keep precepts, keep all these rules, amongst 227 rules of discipline we have to keep, and feel so free. Seems to be a contradiction, doesn't it? If you keep precepts. I don't know, for many of you, this may be your holiday. You may have to go back to work on Monday, and people ask you, what did you do for your holiday? We only ate two meals a day. We gave up a morning meal. We gave up watching television. We sat for hours on a hard cushion. And I wonder, sort of, what? And you had to pay for this as well. And some people, you tell that to them, they think you're crazy. But you say, actually, by doing all this, I feel so much freer, so much healthier, so much more peaceful. I think, well, if you really want to go on a holiday, go off to some club med somewhere and go and play tennis all day and swim until you're so stressed out with competing again that when you come back home, you want to sort of go back to work as a holiday. People don't really understand just what is relaxation, what is peace, what is freedom. But by doing this, you're understanding these things as an experience. When you let go of control, you feel freedom. When you live within precepts, everything is just so natural and pure and joyful. So these are contradictions which ordinary people don't see in the world, but which you see when you meditate. That which works, which gets you past an obstacle in meditation, which makes you more peaceful, that is an enormous area to cultivate wisdom. That is insight. You're seeing that letting go is freedom. You're seeing that virtue is joy. You're seeing that perception is can't be trusted. You're seeing that thinking is concocted. I never actually did give the simile of the Buddha of the five khandhas. He said, when you really see with insight, you see the khanda of the body, just like froth on the river Ganges, has the appearance of solidity and permanence, but just like froth, it's just a heap of bubbles, hundreds, thousands of them, stuck together, and they're always changing, one burst and another one comes to the surface. Look upon this body just like froth. Look upon this feeling, this pleasure pain, which is with every aspect of sensory experience. So like the bubble cord when rain drops on a puddle. Just a little bubble, just for a moment, split second. This feeling, that feeling, this feeling, that feeling. So the Vedana is like the bubbles falling on a body of water, like a puddle. It just, as soon as it arises, it's gone again. And it's insubstantial, it's just a bubble. And he said, I've already said about perception. He said, perception is like a mirage on the road. And you actually see these things when you do your meditation. These perceptions, sometimes the body feels so painful. That's how it appears. And sometimes in your meditation, you can just turn your mind another way around, and the pain is not painful anymore. What is this? Why is my knee aching and sending me crazy one moment? Next moment, there's no pain there. Why is it at one moment the mosquito's landing on me and it's just so irritating, and the next moment it doesn't matter at all? You're beginning to see how perceptions are just like mirages. There's something real there, but by the time it gets to us, it's been just so warped and bent and messed around. We can't trust it. The mental formations, the sankharas, the Buddha said it was like a plantain tree, like a banana tree, because it's only got leaves. It hasn't got no real heart to it, no real substance to it. But I prefer that Venerable Gunaratana simile. He said, very similar, instead of a plantain tree or banana tree, he said like an onion, which is exactly the same, it's just got leaves. It's got nothing solid in the core. The best part of Venerable Gunaratana's simile about an onion, he said an onion goes on and on with an eye in the middle. It's very clever, I really like that one. That's like the thoughts. It goes on and on and on, and there's you in the middle of all of this, and that's why it goes on and on and on, like the onion. And that's a very good simile for the thoughts. It's because we think they're solid, they're worthwhile, there's something substantial in these. That's why we take them seriously. Imagine what it's like if your perceptions and thoughts you don't take seriously anymore. You never get angry at anybody. Because anger always comes with a perception or a thought that this person has done something to hurt you. You never get frustrated at yourself because that comes from a perception or a thought that you can't do it or you haven't done it or this is too much. These are all perceptions and thoughts, if we take seriously, become our prison. So many people are in the prison of perceptions and thoughts. They bind themselves to this reality because they perceive and think this has to be the only one, or the only good one. If you free those bars of perception and thoughts, then you truly can wander wherever you will. And you haven't got an argument with anybody, least of all yourself. And the last of all of the khandhas was consciousness, which the Buddha, I guess we call consciousness, the magician. The magician at the crossroads exhibiting his tricks. That's all consciousness is. A very sharp magician who fools a lot of people. And those are the similes of the five khandhas. And you can experience the truth of these in your meditation. Whenever you come across an obstacle, it's usually because you're misunderstanding one of the khandhas to be something that they're not, believing in perception, believing in thought, blah, blah, blah. And every time you see the obstacle, you overcome it, you always get more peaceful. You go just that one stage deeper in your meditation. This is why you know it's insight. Not just something superficial, not just an idea or a theory, but you're seeing into the nature of what causes suffering, what causes the easing of suffering. That's why it's called deep insight. The more you do this, the more you get the hang of the Buddha's teachings. Not only do you gain deep states of mind, but you gain the attitudes, the skills, which give rise to those deep states of mind. You're lessening the fetters, you're weakening them. The more the defilements are weakened, the easier it is to meditate. Until all the defilements are completely shattered, then meditation becomes a breeze. So this is why that it's the insight teaches stillness. Stillness teaches insight. And you should have experienced that by now. Doesn't matter how much you gained in stillness, how much progress towards the jhanas, what is more important than that is always why. What you've learnt on the journey. Doesn't matter how far you've reached, it's what you've learnt on the journey is what is going to stay with you, and it's what you're going to take on your next journey. So that's the, as it were, like the summing up talk for this morning. I'm going to ask you a question for a change. I'm not quite sure what time this meditation retreat actually finishes this afternoon. Between 3 and 4, is it? Okay, is that acceptable to everyone, 3 and 4? Sorry? You want to get your money's worth, don't you? I mean, you mean 12 o'clock tonight? So if it's say it's 3 o'clock, then maybe what we can do is keep the usual schedule of 1:30. We can do some walking meditation or sit in here, and if I can ask everyone to come in between 2 and 3. So at 2 o'clock we'll do like 30 minutes meditation, then at 2:30 I'll start. We usually finish, and it's a lovely way to finish, doing a metta meditation at 2:30. Spreading loving kindness to all the world, and then I'll do a little bit of a blessing chant at the very end. We can finish about 3. And dedication of merits we can do as well, yes. Part of the blessing. So that we'll do it between 2:30 and 3. So if everyone can come back for between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock, and we'll finish at 3. So get your money's worth. Is an opportunity which cannot be missed. Okay, so that's any questions about the talk now? Anyone wishes to ask? It's very good, isn't it? The end of all questions.